I'm going to start this right now. Okay, this is Sarah Milligan. I'm in Mount Sterling, Kentucky. It's February 23rd, 2008. Long day. I'm interviewing Robert C. Haynes Sr. about his World War II experience.
Yes.
All right. So tell me a little bit about how that experience started for you.
Well, the experience started in 1946. During the war, my father had gone to Baltimore to work, and I stayed 1 year with him, and we moved there from Jenkins, Kentucky, and we moved there for that 1 year, and I went to Patterson Park High School. My father was encouraging me. I was a sophomore, and my father was encouraging me to join the Navy. And he said, "Oh, look at all the benefits that you can get when the war is over. You can get the GI Bill of Rights and all this." And I was thinking about that, but I wasn't ready for the Navy because I'm a mountain boy. And so the other thing my father didn't realize is that my mother had a lot of control over me. And when he mentioned that, it almost led to divorce, but anyway, I finished school, and then the next year I came back to Kentucky to finish high school at Jenkins High School. I played basketball and was a fairly good player, and I had a scholarship in 1946, June of 46, I had a scholarship to go to Union College, but I had a mind of my own. I, first of all, needed to have my teeth taken care of. And I needed to have, I wanted to get married.
Did you have a girlfriend?
Oh, yes, I had a girlfriend. One. And so I wanted to get married. And I didn't have a job after school.
You were 18?
I was 17.
When you graduated high school?
When I graduated. So what happened was that the Union College wanted us to send in a $10 deposit fee for room. And my mother and father, we were still living there. I was living with her. Dad was still in Baltimore. He was a guard in the shipyard there. But anyway, my mother had to scrounge around to get $10, and I was a realist. And I said, "Well, how am I going to go to school? I don't have any. I have one suit that I had worked in the summer in Baltimore, Maryland, and I bought a suit. And that's one suit I had to take to college." So I was a realist, and I knew that things weren't just right. And I wanted to be independent, just my nature. And so what happened is I was walking down the street with my friend, a boy by the name of Harold Bryant. And we both were from Burdine, Kentucky. I was out in the country. He was in town. And I said, "Harold, Let's join the Army." And Harold looked at me and says, "Okay." And so we went over to Norton, Virginia, so told we wanted to join the Army, and we joined. And then we went to, later on, in about a week, we went to Roanoke, Virginia, and were sworn in. And then from there, we went up to Fort Meade, Maryland, to get our Army uniforms and all of this. And then I ended up in June, July, and August in Fort McClellan, Alabama. And it was hot. It was hot. So basic training. But the hostilities were over, but the war was not officially over. And so they needed people to come in and to relieve the soldiers that had been fighting. And so
So were you 18 by the time you enlisted?
I was still 17.
Did your parents have to sign?
No, because it was the month the same month as my birthday, so they took me on my own word.
Was your mom mad?
No. Okay. No. Mother was a little bit of a realist, too. And so, anyway.
You're in Alabama.
In Fort McClellan. They shipped me out to Fort McClellan, Alabama in June, July, and August. Wow. The temperature was hot. And with basic training that was going on, it was 8 weeks then. Because they needed people to let other people come home. They needed people over there to be the occupational force, if you will. And so I underwent basic training. And I don't know why, but one of the sergeants that was in charge of training said to me, he said, "Have you ever thought about going to OCS and officers training school?"
Okay.
And so I said, "Well, no, I really don't plan a career in the armed services." So anyway, I did pretty well in there. They liked me pretty well, and so gave me a furlough, 2 weeks. I went home. I was married. I got my wife got benefits of being a married wife. Always thinking ahead, trying to, you know. And so they had worked on my teeth, and a doctor had told me, "You're going to lose all your teeth. Can I pull them all out and give you..." This was in Jenkins.
Oh, in Jenkins they were going to pull your teeth.
And I said, "No, I don't want my teeth out."
Why did he think he needed to pull your teeth?
Well, I had not taken care of my teeth as well as I should have, because I'd never been taught that. Mm-hmm. Well, when I got in the Army, they taught us that. And they gave us a toothbrush and toothpaste, and they expected you to... And so he extracted about four of my teeth, and all the rest were filled, and I never had to... I still have today. I'm 79 years old, and I still have the same teeth that I had when I got out of the Army.
Wow.
And I've never had maybe one or two decays, but not much. So
your goals, you're married, your teeth are taken care of.
Yeah, and I've got some income now, and I'm building for the future. I wanted to be a teacher, and so I'm building for the future. And so I suffered the heat, the 102, and doing judo out on the field in the hot weather.
They taught you judo?
Oh, yeah. And marched us. DKP occasionally, if you weren't careful. Kitchen police, what happens is you go to at 3 o'clock in the morning, you get up and you go in and peel potatoes and you do work in the kitchen getting ready for the men when they came in to eat breakfast. So all of us wanted to dodge that.
Yeah.
But anyway, I got out of that and went home, was married, left after the 2 weeks, and went to Camp Stoneman, California,
wow,
near Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to be shipped overseas. And that's where I also was taken care of health-wise, shots and everything. And then in just about 2 weeks or so, I got on a ferry boat going out to get on the ship, the General Collins in San Francisco Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, we got shots and examinations and cleaning out the ears, the wax in the ears, and all of this. And then we were on the ship. But to get to the ship, you had to get on a ferry boat.
Mm-hmm.
And the sign says up above, as you go to get on the ferry boat, "Through these portals pass the best damn soldiers in the world."
Really?
And so I didn't feel that way. So I got on the little ferry boat, and I'd never been on a boat before. And so it would rock from side to side, and I got a little seasick before I even got on the ship. And so anyway, they took me down and put me on the ship. So I got on the ship and they started looking around for people to work KP and for work details, they call it. Mm-hmm. And they nabbed me, but they did one thing. They forgot to get my name. So they took us to the station, the work station. And mine was in the mess hall there. And the thing is, I went in and there was the cook of the ship, and he was eating a hot dog. And I was already sick.
No.
And so when he turned his back, I laid down right next to the whiskey. And since he had my name, I had figured it out. He doesn't have my name. So when he went back, I disappeared. I went down, I knew where I was to be assigned. So I went down, there was four people. One on a canvas bed, mm-hmm. another one, three people bunked.
Mm-hmm.
So I got into a bunk and they never did find me.
Oh.
And so I was getting to feel a little better because it was still anchored.
Yeah.
Then we headed for Hawaii and the Philippines.
Were you seasick the whole way?
No, over to Hawaii,
yeah.
Yes.
Oh. What happened to your friend you enlisted with?
He came the same place, but a little bit after me. And so we got separated.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got on the ship, and the first stop was Hawaii. I was feeling bad all the way over, but I didn't watch the water. They said, don't watch the water. And so I stayed pretty much under. The weather was a little rough. So we got out in Hawaii, and I didn't understand. They gave us 2 days leave. I didn't understand why, when I stepped out on the ground seemed to be coming up at me. You know, because on the ship, we got the waves. So anyway, I got back on the ship, and wonderful. This was in late September.
1946.
So what happened was, is that I was there, and the water was as smooth as glass. I started feeling good. And I got out and got on the deck. We'd sleep out on the deck at night. And everything was fine until we were about 3 days out of Manila, mm-hmm. the Philippines, and a typhoon hit.
While you were on the boat?
Yes. And the ship's bow was going way up, and then it would fall and hit the trough and shake and everything, and I was down four stories down, and one of the guys wanted to look and see, so he'd gone up to look out, and a big wave had hit and knocked him down the metal stairways, and so they locked us in. So here it was, and we knew what was happening, and went up, came down, and then what happened? The motor, the engine of the ship went out. The lights went out. You could hear the glasses breaking in the kitchen. And some of the guys had been shaking the dice, and I wasn't, but they've been using foul language and everything. It changed from foul language over to praying real quick. And so when that happened, and you couldn't see a thing, and so I came out on the guy under me, I came out on his neck, and he was from Texas. But anyway, we were being tossed around, and we could feel it. And then the lights came back on. But the guys had been rolling the dice. They were praying like everything. And so anyway, we finally moved out of that into the straits going into Manila Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was calm and everything. And so I ended up at the 29th Engineer Base Topographic Battalion, which was a space. But there was a battalion headquarters was there. But there were no places for us to live. And so we had to put up tents. It was a rainy season, starts in October.
Mm-hmm.
The rainy season came in. And the beds were metal, and we put the beds, opened them up, got a mattress, and it was, the rain was coming down, and the water was running in through the through the ground under in the tent. It didn't have any floor in it. And the beds, in the morning, you'd wake up, and the bed was about, 4 or 5 inches from the from it, where it sunk down from the water that
was flowing
through. Yeah, in the mud. So anyway, that went along.
So you joined the Army, but you ended up spending a lot of time on boats.
Just maybe 3 or 4 weeks. But anyway, what happened next was I'm not the carpenter type. And they were looking for work details again. Mm-hmm. And I would watch the non-coms coming that were looking for work people, and I would go in the other direction.
And you were getting used to sneak
yeah.
away.
Oh, I was learning how to be an Army man. And so I did that. Then one morning, they had improved everything, and it gradually improved. It wasn't bad. But one morning, I was there, and over the PA system, it says, "Robert Haynes, report to battalion headquarters." And immediately, I was scared. I was 18, barely 18 now. And I was scared. I said, they've caught up with me for dodging all these details. And so I was frightened, really scared. So I went to battalion headquarters. I walked in, trembling a little bit. And the sergeant looked at me. Personnel sergeant major looked at me and says, "Sit down." I said, "Yes, sir." It didn't matter. Everyone was sir as far as I was concerned. And I was a PFC. So I sat down. And he was looking at my records. He says, "You've had accounting?" "Yes." "Yes, sir." "You've had typing?" "Yes, sir." "You've done pretty well in your sciences?" "Yes." "Yes, sir." And he said, "Okay." He says, "You've got a pretty good record. How would you like to be the company sergeant, company clerk for the 3361st Base Survey Company?" And I said, "I'll take it."
18 years old.
"I'll take it." So I became the company clerk, the battalion company clerk. And I did payrolls and all that sort of thing. And my personnel sergeant major, he's in charge of all personnel records and everything. And when I'd type something, he would not accept erasures. I had to have it perfect. And I would take it up to him, and he would hold it up and look at it. And if there had been an eraser mark on it, he'd say, "Do it over." And so I did it over.
Do you feel like you got that position because you had had typing?
Typing and bookkeeping and a pretty good grade they looked at the IQ test too that you give in the Army, and that was above average. And so with that in mind, I went ahead and took that job.
So you felt fortunate to...
Oh, Lord. What? Compare that. Sitting at a typewriter, compare that to out here with a hammer and carrying wood and all that business. I didn't like that. So I was forced. So, and how fortunate I was. And this was a 29th Engineer Base Topographic Battalion.
Which means what?
It means that its mission was to do the mapping, both aerial mapping, and with all the companies in there, each one had a mission. With aerial mapping, photographic, with surveying out in the field, going to the islands, and making maps.
In the Philippines. What?
And there's 1,117 islands in the Philippines.
So what constituted the need for the mapping? Had people not been stationed there?
The mission was this, to map. And to take all maps that previously existed, validate them, but also to train the Filipinos to to do this mapping themselves. So that was the mission. And I was fortunate to be in the engineers. My friend later on came over and he was in the MPs. I was just so fortunate to get in the 29th Engineer Base Topographic Battalion. One was the most wonderful experience of my life.
What was so memorable about it?
Well, first of all, I worked real hard. I was very courteous, and they liked me. They liked me. And so what happened is they jumped me up to a corporal, and then they moved me up to company headquarters, it's called. Mm-hmm. The headquarters company. And so they moved me up to that, and then this personnel sergeant major was getting ready to come back to the United States. He had been there a long time. So he called me up one day and said, would you like to become the personnel sergeant major for the battalion? And I said, what does that mean? He said, well, it means you get a promotion. And so through some efforts that went on, I eventually got promoted up to a staff sergeant at age 19.
Wow.
And my brother-in-law was at Clark Field, and he came down to visit, and the colonel of the battalion liked me. The company commander liked me. And the sergeant major of the battalion, the man by the name of Smith, he liked me. And I was always the one that did. I worked real hard and with a good attitude. Mm-hmm. And attitude made the difference. So what happened is that I got promoted to personnel sergeant major and the staff sergeant in time, and meant more money. It meant that I got at the mess hall, I got a place to eat more, family style. Mm-hmm. And then it also meant on the weekends I could check out a weapons carrier or jeep to go out and see some things around Manila and in Clark Field and up near there, and where the volcano that erupted in the 1990s, Patino. Patubo. I'm too basketball oriented. Patubo. And so I got to visit there 40 some years afterwards it erupted.
Yeah.
And so I got to go to Corregidor,
which is
right near Manila, and that's of course in the Philippines. That was the last place that we had before we had to surrender. General Wainwright MacArthur had been there, but he took off in February. The President of the United States ordered MacArthur to come home. And so he sent PT boats up to pick him up, and also the President of the Philippines at that time was Corazon. And he picked him up, and then he came back, and MacArthur and his family left Corregidor, which where we were our last defense.
Yeah.
And Corregidor is right at the mouth of the bay.
Yeah.
And you can be on Corregidor and look out, and you can see Bataan just about 8 miles away, and another place about 8 miles. You could look out and you could see these archipelagos there.
How did that make you feel? I mean, being there after all of this huge upshift, and you're there post that, how did your interactions with the Filipino people, and how did that make you feel?
Well, I love the Filipino people. I really do. Because I had two guys that were Filipino scouts, and their army, our army paid soldiers, and they had two companies, and they were assigned to the battalion. And so I taught them how to type, and I worked with them, and they liked me. And so what happens is that they invited me to play basketball with them. And so I started on the weekends, and sometimes at night, but mainly weekends. What would happen is I would go out to the barrios with this team, and they had stringed lights around the perimeter of the basketball court, just bare bulbs, and it was dirt. court. And then they had smoke coming up to get rid of the mosquitoes. And so we would play basketball against Filipino teams. And they just, I was very much accepted. And so wherever I went, it was always with courtesy.
That's great.
And I cared for them and they cared for me.
That's a very good relationship.
Yes.
What politically, how did it sit? Were you all there? Was it accepted? Did you feel like you were welcome there to do the mapping, to do the...
Oh, yes. We were, and I was... In June of 1946, the Philippines was granted nationhood. They became a nation. MacArthur was one. By the way, MacArthur is revered in the Philippines. His name still there. And we were on Highway 54, which was named MacArthur Boulevard in the Philippines. It has a new name now, but it was there. But anyway, these Filipino scouts was one, but in July the 4th of 1946, MacArthur and others gave them the statehood, nationhood. And so I was there on their first anniversary. And now the Filipino soldiers they didn't have this uniforms like our scouts did and all of this, but on that day, they were lined up all along boulevards for miles and miles and miles, standing there at attention that day. And it was a celebration that they had been looking forward to since 1898. That's when they wanted, the guerrillas had been fighting the Spanish. And so when Dewey won the battle there and the Spanish gave up Cuba at that time, they gave up the Filipinos, they sold the Philippines to us for $20 million. That's another whole story. But anyway, when I got to Corregidor, I saw the Malinta Tunnel, and that's where we had dug tunnels to keep the bombs from damaging us there. We had dug tunnels back in the rocks and for hundreds of feet back with side branches. And when General Wainwright had to surrender there, MacArthur had taken off to get to Australia. The president had ordered him to come. And so he went on PT boat number 41 down to Mindanao, and then they flew him over to Australia, and then from Australia, in Australia, he finally ended up in Sydney, Adelaide, and then Sydney.
So at 19, when you're here, do you have this sense of kind of the devastation that's just happened? I mean, there was the Bataan Death March. There's all of these horrific things that happened in that region, and they really fought to the end. You know, that last stronghold. Did you feel that?
Yes, and I took pictures. And I took a picture where MacArthur had stood with the ideas when he came back in 1945. And he said, raise the colors of the flag and let no enemy ever take it down again. And so I stood there. Also, I stood at the entrance of this Malinta Tunnel. It says, beware. The booby traps do not enter. The booby traps are here, and so don't go in. And also, snakes are in there. Well, the booby traps didn't bother me too much. But when he says snakes, no. I'm in the mountains, and when he says snakes, I didn't want to go back in there. So anyway, then on the beach, you walked along, and I've got a picture of this out here. But you had little Japanese shoes, and machine guns and everything rusting out, they were still there. All of that when I went over. And I was mentioning the Malinta Tunnel. When Wainwright surrendered for all the Philippines, he surrendered there to the Japanese. The reason he surrendered is because the next day the Japanese were coming in with superior forces, they didn't have much left. They had over 1,000 people in the hospital back in here. And he says, what's one more day of freedom if we get all these thousands of people killed? So he surrendered. And when MacArthur received him later, the Japanese had shifted him around. He was in Outer Mongolia. And when the Russians came in, they liberated him. But when he came, he was emaciated, you know, he was lost weight and everything. Yeah. But when he came in and he saw MacArthur, he burst out crying. And so, but MacArthur says, you were a hero. Yeah. So, and we treated him as a hero and gave him a promotion to general, and then he ended up his army career. Then. Yeah. But anyway, that was to look over and see these shoes, little pieces of clothing and machine guns and bayonets and all of this on the beach where the fighting had occurred, you see, was quite sobering, really, when you see all of that.
Well, I wonder how that is. You know, you came in as kind of, as you said, kind of to be what could be an occupational force. You know, you're
yes.
really there to reconstruct and work or create peace or
yes.
whatever.
Build friendships.
So since you were there after all the combat took place, it seems like you're in a happier role, but there's still those pieces.
Yeah, I told you earlier that I had gotten a weapons carrier I could check out. And so some friends and I were in the weapons carrier coming back, and it was at nighttime. And we were driving down this Highway 54, MacArthur Boulevard. It's probably about 10 miles out. And this brand new Ford came up right next to us and was trying to force me off the road. And you see, the Huck Bellahops were there. That was a communist group. The Huck Bellahops were still trying to take over. So it was this car was trying to force me over, and I said, he's got a new Ford, I've got a weapons carrier, so he's not going to force me over. So I would cut back at him, and so we ran for about 3 or 4 miles like that. And then over here we passed a Jeep and had a machine gun on the elevated up on the back.
You passed an American Jeep
on the right. And so this Jeep saw what was going on, and he started out, and he was souped up, I guess, but he was after that Ford, and he was really going after him. And so when we went a few more miles, the Jeep pulled us over. It was MPs, really, what it was. Pulled us over and says, you better get back to your headquarters, because this car, they were after your vehicle. The car, the men in the back had Tommy guns, and so it would be dangerous. So I said, yes, sir. And so we went back, but they found a way to integrate them to United States and the Philippine government to alleviate some of the concerns and the gripes and of the communists there, and so they lost some favor. But they were called we called them the Huck Bellahops, but they were just called Hucks later on, HUKS, Hucks.
Why did you call them the Huck Bellahops? Is that their real name?
I don't know. That was, but I looked up on Google, and they now I saw where they call them the Hucks, HUKS. So it was, and you would walk downtown Manila in early 1940, late 46 there, and you would see bandoliers and rifles among the population there. And so, but I was never threatened, and they didn't threaten Americans at that time. Mm-hmm. But there was the Hucks and the guerrillas of various kind. And
did you ride home a lot?
Oh, yes. I was married.
Newlywed.
Yeah, 2 weeks. But, yes, I wrote. But one of the things, interesting things, is that I remember going downtown, and I've got a picture showing that you don't have the big skyscrapers and things then. It was near the Passaic River. But they had these stalls, these saloons or stalls set up, and you get your picture taken, and you get little artifacts, knives, and polished stones, and lapidarian was at work, and coats, and all of this, and they would embroider the coats in the back, like 29th Engineer based on graphic battalion, that you could send home and where you could keep.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was a business place. Mm-hmm. And but you go in, and amazing thing, I would hear this voice. It says, "Hey, Hop, Bella Hop, get your boulot." Let me see. What is it? Turn it off just. Balut. Okay. "Hey, get your balut, 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 balut." And I said, "Well, there was a balut." And I'd see them over, and they would be eating something. And I said, "What is that?" They'd say, "Balut. It's a balut." And so I went back to my office. And the next day I said, "What is a balut?" And they say, "Oh," says, "that is an incubated egg, duck egg, incubated duck egg, for the they put the heat and the conditions to it and time it, and at a certain time they take it out and it becomes a balut, and it's a delicacy."
So it's an unhatched duck.
Yes, a developing embryo.
Right.
Inside the egg. And so the people I asked, it was two clerks, they were Filipino ladies that were working in the filing room, and they said, "Did you get one to eat?" I said, "No. Have you ever eaten?" "Oh yes, we eat balloons." I said, "No, don't get close to me."
So you never tried one?
No, I wouldn't be one of those.
So how long were you over in the Philippines?
14 months.
14 months.
Yes.
Did you wish it was longer? Was that enough?
No, that was enough. I was wanting to come home because my brother-in-law, who was a photographer for working with the engineering photographic company,
mm-hmm.
he's from Clark Field. The survey, he was there, and he was a captain, I think. But he came down and he talked to my company, my battalion commander, mm-hmm. who was a West Point man, Colonel Dirks. And when you saw him, you would know him. A West Point man stands tall, straight. When he walks, you know he's a West Point man. And so he goes for the rules. He sticks there for the rules. So anyway, Colonel Dirks, when my captain brother-in-law came down, Colonel Dirks, he led him around, took him around the company, and he talked to him about me. And so he told me, he says, "Here you are, a high school student, you're already a staff sergeant." He says, "You can be a master sergeant here just with putting your time in." He says, "I talked to Colonel Dirks. He would like for you to re-up." And, well, that didn't interest me. So he said, "But you just got a high school education." And he was a graduate of Berea. Mm-hmm. And so I said, "That's okay. I want to become a teacher." But I said, "Thank you for advising me of this." So I gave it some thought. I decided not to, and I decided to go home.
After 2 years?
Yeah, 14 months.
14 months.
And so I had made friends with, over the phone, never seen him, with a Mr. Green, who was a warrant officer. And I told him about me being sick on the ships. And he said, "Well, how would you like to fly home?" And I said, "I would love it. Oh, thank you." And he says, "Well, you pick out about five or about six or seven of your friends that are due to be rotated back, and send me their names and we'll fly them home. And they cut the orders, you see, up there. So I did, and so I flew into Sacramento to the air base there, and they I mustered out.
How did you find Mr. Green?
I sent all my reports to him. See, I assembled all of the company reports, and I got in trouble with that once, but I assembled it, and I got it to him, and I got it on time, and he said that mine was the best reports that had come in. So he liked me, and then we talked, and he found out about me, and I found out a little bit about him, and so it just worked out that way.
Yeah.
But the interesting one there is that we had another company there, and the company commanders are pretty powerful. You know, they control the companies. They are responsible. And so this photographic company, photomapping company, they've been their first sergeant had not been sending in his reports on time. And so I took a routing slip and I said, send it down. I marked the company, 2661. I marked the company, sent the routing slip down, and I had to do that for several reports in several weeks. And so one day, the company commander came up and went in to see Colonel Dirks and the sergeant major for the battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in trouble. He brought all of those routing slips. And he said, look at this. He's just a non-commissioned officer. Look what he's doing. He's telling me what I must do. And so so I was in trouble. So he says, I want him busted.
Were you doing something beyond your job, or was that what you were supposed to be doing?
It's what I was supposed to do. But when they were kind to me. The personnel officer was kind, and the commanding officer was kind. And I said, well, I've been having trouble getting their reports. And I know the first sergeant's responsible for getting the reports in. So I was sending it to the first sergeant saying, I've got to have it. And because I've got to get it on to our headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
And so, anyway, the company commander, the battalion commander told the company commander, get the reports in on time. And said, and we'll work this out without any problems. So he called me and he says, I want you to go down and I want you to apologize to and tell what you told me to the company commander. So I went down and I told the company commander. And he says, mm-hmm. He said, well, I understand, young man. He said, but let me tell you a story. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, there's a barber. And says, he's got a customer that comes in. And this customer comes in and he's been in the construction business. He's got dirt all over his face. And he wants a shave and a haircut. And the barber hates anyone that comes in, especially with dirt in their ears. And he says, he gets up in the chair and the barber looks at him. So the barber's got to make some decisions. And the decision is this. If I'm clean out his ear, saying, oh, I've got some soap in your ear, clean it out, and clean the face off a little bit with soap, and makes the man feel good. And he'll get out of the chair, and he'll feel like coming back. Now, if that's one decision I've got to make. Now, the other part of the decision is this. If I take my cover here, sheet, and I pull it off and say, get out of my chair, go in there and wash your face and ears and come back. He says, I've lost a customer for life, for all the time I'm in business. He says, now, which thing would you choose? And he says, always look at the results and try to know. And I said, of course, I would make him feel good. He says, now, young man, that's tact. So you always remember that definition for tact. and I have all of my life. And so from then on, I try to be a little more thankful in dealing with.
Make them feel good.
Absolutely.
So what did you do when you came back? You were flown back into Sacramento. You presumably flew back home to your new.
No, I didn't fly. I got on a train to Chicago.
Okay.
Got on the train to Chicago and flew and came back to Chicago. Got on a bus and got off the train at Lexington. Got on the bus, and while I was on the train, it was the last few days of October, I was on the train, and it was early November, and oh, the whole train became solemn all at once. It says, we've just heard a man of war died. And so I know when he died in 1947, the first part of November, because that was there. Well, now I've got to go to Jenkins, Kentucky. There's no train. And bus station's downtown Lexington. So I go downtown Lexington to get on the bus, and it only goes to Hazard. And I said, well, that's closer home. And my wife's there. So I rode the bus up to Hazard, got out. It was early in the morning. No bus was leaving till the next day around 11 o'clock or something. And so I hired a taxi and took a taxi over. And it cost me $6, I think. But anyway, I was going home. And then I got home, and then, oh Lord, I was responsible. I had to work. I had to find a place. But I decided to go to school, so I came down to Transylvania. And I talked with the most wonderful woman in the world, Dean Jennings. She was from Cynthiana. And so I went down, and she enrolled me under the GI Bill of Rights. And so my wife and I could play basketball. And so I came down and went to school. And after the first quarter, I said, if college is like this, I don't want it. Because they didn't give me a good scheduling, my advisor did. He had me scattered through the whole day. And I lived out in town with kitchen privileges then, with my wife. And she was there all day. And in January, she became pregnant. And I added to the baby boom. And so
there are several of you here today that added to the baby boom.
Yeah, and so what happened was is that I took, and they gave me a course called Philosophy of Education under Dr. Crawford, Crawford Junior High School or Middle School is named after him. He and his wife, and they gave me that course, Philosophy of Education, Rousseau, Descartes, all these people. I couldn't even read the book hardly. And then they gave me English with themes, and I'd never written a theme before. And I remember one theme I wrote about my early schooling, one room, two-room school. And I wrote the theme. It came back, and the teacher asked me, would you mind if I circulate this to all the other professors? And so I said, no, it's okay. But I had gotten a C+ or something. Content was outstanding, but the red marks on grammar wasn't too good.
So what did you want to teach?
Of course, there's only one thing that you do when you're a boy from Eastern Kentucky. You want to coach basketball and teach history. And so
it might still be that way.
But it didn't take me long. It didn't take me long. I dropped out, by the way, after that.
After your first semester?
First quarter.
Three
quarters. I dropped out and went back. Oh, I worked in the coal mines.
In Jenkins.
In Pike County. And so, but you have to work money. You got a child coming. And then I had lots of experiences there. But it didn't take me long, after about 6 months, to know that wasn't what I... School was better than this. So I set my goal to come back to school, and Dean Jennings, bless her heart, from Cynthiana, she had been in a private school in 1941, December, and the private school, boarding school for women. She was way up in the administration, so she'd come back. They confiscated the school for the FBI or the CIA.
Oh.
And they took over the school and says, tell them to go home. And they took it over and said,
in Kentucky?
Go back to Kentucky. Yeah. You go back.
Where was the school located?
In Arlington. In Arlington, Virginia.
Right.
And so right out of Washington. And so anyway, she came back, but she was the dean of students. And she wrote me and asked me, what could we do to help you come back to school? Mm-hmm. Ask me. And I said, well, I need this place to live. And they had just jumped the GI Bill to $125 a month, plus all your tuition stuff.
Right.
One best investment they've ever made with me, because and all the GIs, because they paid back in taxes thousands of times.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I decided to come back, and I came back in January of '48, and to play basketball. And I came back. Then, education course. Dr. Crawford was also in charge of placement when you graduate. And so I took a course with him toward my sophomore year. And he said, now I've got needs of teachers. And he said, when it comes to history teachers and coaches, I've got two for the whole state. I mean, all that I've got in my office, two they want. And but for science teachers, I have a request for 30 some. And he said, you know how many I have? None. And I'd taken a course in economics under Dr. Hall. And Dr. Hall says, if I come into your house and I punch you, he says, I expect you to just wake up and say, supply and demand. And so I'm intelligent enough where I say, supply and demand, I can see that. And I'd just taken a course with Dr. Brown, and all the other students, for some reason, were having trouble in anatomy and physiology. I was his top student. It was easy for me.
Mm-hmm.
I could learn it well. And so I changed my major over to biology.
Smart.
And you've got to look at the future. And I was being tactful. I was looking ahead.
So were you a biology teacher?
Yes, and biology. And my faculty liked me at Transylvania. For some reason, I don't know why, but I wanted to learn so bad at Transylvania. And so they nominated me for a Carnegie Fellowship for teachers for Peabody College, which is part of Vanderbilt now, but Peabody College. And they were going to take 20 from throughout the United States. And so I applied, and I was selected, and I had another child on the way. I sold an old house that I had bought up in the mountains. And that was my food for that year, but my tuition and a little allowance was there. So I made it through and got my master's degree in June.
Mm-hmm.
And I taken extra courses, and I got my master's degree in June. And not only that, but all in science and secondary education, but mostly in science.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened is that a teacher from Cullman, Alabama, or superintendent from Cullman, Alabama, asked the faculty, who would you recommend? And the faculty at Peabody recommended me. And so I got a job. It's the first job I was offered. And they started me out with a master's degree with the salary that they could give. And so I went down, and they hired me to teach chemistry and biology and coach at middle school, at junior high school. So I took it. And the thing is, I never I dodged chemistry because it was so hard at Transylvania. The word of mouth was stay away from it. So I took a blitz course in chemistry that summer, a full year's course in the summer. And it was paid for by my Carnegie Fellowship, you see, it's continued. And so I went to Coleman and taught chemistry and biology and coached.
For how long? How long were you there?
1 year.
1 year.
Yes, and got a job to go to Arlington, Virginia. One of my friends had got his doctorate. He was a principal up there.
So your family was following you all these places?
Everywhere I went.
Wow.
My family.
How did you end up in Mount Sterling?
Well, I got interested in learning. And so while I was at Peabody, I had done well. And so I entered the doctoral program there.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went to Arlington later, National Sputnik had gone up. And so I got a National Science Foundation for the summer at Maryland. And then for the year long, I had my choice of North Carolina or Colorado. And I said, well, I'll never get to go west again. And I read Zane Grey's books on, oh, I loved them. And so I said, I'm going to Boulder, Colorado. So I went out there and got another master's degree. And then I came back and to Transylvania, and I taught there. They invited me to come back and teach. Two master's degree and my bachelor's. And so Dr. Brown was the dean, and I had been his one of his better students.
Mm-hmm.
So I came back and I taught there.
Uh-huh.
And
for how long?
9 years.
9 years.
9 years. And then I 9 years in science and then 2 years in a combination of science and education. I became the director of student teaching because it had gotten to be a mess. And so teachers weren't wanting our teachers, so I got in and I went out. And pretty soon I had back up to 40 teachers, and I was teaching fundamentals of secondary education.
Oh.
And as director of student teaching. And so
yeah.
I was getting elementary students, and I was getting high school students for certification. So anyway, I taught there, and then this same friend who brought me to Arlington
mm-hmm.
Was now the assistant superintendent in Richmond, Virginia. And they offered me, brought me up as a consultant, and then they offered me a job for a new regional mathematics and science center. It's brand new for 8 school districts, 120,000 students base, and plus it meant working all year, and it meant a $5,000 raise. And when you're making $6,000, that's you tend to go where the money is.
Yeah, it's almost doubling your salary.
Yeah, so that's what I did.
That's fascinating. From trying to decide what to do out of Jenkins, Kentucky, and whether you can afford $10 for the dorm room. So two master's degrees and professional consultation and people inviting you all over the place. And
I've been a Fulbright scholar.
Fulbright.
And
Carnegie
and a fellow and a Fulbright scholar. And then I was invited to speak in Pakistan. And so to a group over there on manpower development.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then I ran into a friend and a Fulbright scholar mm-hmm. to China.
Wow.
7 weeks there, studying the history and culture of China.
Oh my goodness.
But it all started with the GI Bill of Rights. It gave me opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And here it was. I've had the most wonderful life. There's not a time in my life that I've really been unhappy in my job.
That's great.
And I'm still going. I'm retired, of course. But I ended up in Montgomery County after I was in the Math Science Center. By the way, that center is still going 40 years ago.
Wow.
Still going. So I did well with it. And they're still using the pattern that I established there. But I decided to become the superintendent of schools, so
mm-hmm.
while I was there. And I needed to get certified as a superintendent. So I had to go to VPI, I had to go to the University of Virginia, I had to get certification. So I did that. And then I became the superintendent, one of the superintendents in Chesterfield County, right out of Richmond.
Mm-hmm.
He had worked with me, and so he invited me to come to Roanoke as his assistant superintendent.
Right.
And so I went up there, and that was filled with my goal. Mm-hmm. And I got some experience, and then I went to Fredericksburg, Virginia. And from Fredericksburg, then my grandchildren now were in Henry County, Kentucky.
Right.
So I came back, and I did my missionary work there. Because I'd never been in a country school before. I'd been in the city schools.
Right.
And so, and one of the things I've been noted for in Virginia and other places, I've been noted for being innovative and making changes. And so,
that's a positive thing to have said about you.
Yeah. And this, and here, I'm now, I've been the president of the Rotary Club. I've been the president of the Chamber of Commerce.
In Montgomery County?
Mm-hmm. And I've been the governor of Rotary District 6740, which is all of eastern and central Kentucky and some of northern Kentucky. And I started the foundation when I was here, and I worked part-time with it, and now it's part-time with no pay. I chose that myself.
Mm-hmm.
And but I built programs and innovated. And so I've had a wonderful, wonderful life.
It's good that you've contributed so much.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And they did put me in the Hall of Fame here, the Chamber of Commerce Hall of Fame, for the modern period.
Oh, good.
So
you get some recognition.
Yeah.
I bet you get a lot of recognition for the things you do.
Yeah, I've had more than I deserve, really.
I doubt that, but I bet you've got a lot. Well,
and here's my latest project.
This is your story of where you've been with the pictures that you have.
Yes.
I think that's...
And story and history. It has. I still love history. And
mm-hmm.
So I'm a Graecophile.
So this is China, Pakistan, Taiwan... Paris, not in Kentucky.
No.
Oxford, London, Athens, Philippine Islands.
And that's where...
And then Corregidor is what you were saying.
Yeah. And all of these are the most exciting places in the world. I just enjoyed it. I've built friendship. And I've helped... I was the ambassadorial scholar chairman for... the Rotary Club.
Wow.
And so we've interviewed people and sent them to come
right.
with fellowships.
Yes. Yeah.
And then we've received them too.
Right.
And I worked with Dr. Rotary at Moorhead, and actually back in the 80s when I was superintendent here, 86 to 90, what we did, Dr. Rotary and I worked out a course in the history and culture and language introduction for
mm-hmm.
China.
Oh, wow.
And we put it in the high school. He put it in Moorhead.
That's great.
I put it in here. And
that's great that's a possibility.
Yeah, and I brought one of the interpreters from Shanghai. I brought here to teach that.
Wow.
A half a day.
And you have the connections.
And I've got them now.
Oh.
I still have them.
Well, it's been an hour. It's been a whole hour. I just thank you guys. It's been great. You're very entertaining storyteller. I'm gonna go ahead. One addendum.
My wife passed on January the 19th.
Just two weeks ago.
A month ago.
So. Oh gosh.
And she had Alzheimer's, but she died of pneumonia and had a bout with that. But I've been her caretaker for Alzheimer's for 2 years.
Wow.
And this I did while I was there. I was with her constantly, never letting her out of my sight unless that I had someone I could trust with her.
Yeah.
But
so you made that book, the publication that went along with your pictures during
yes.
that time?
Yes. But the thing is, I want to mention this. she was such a wonderful woman. And what all of this moving around, we moved.
Yes.
And she worked at Bryan Station for 9 years and so, and worked at the University of Richmond for the president there. And she was the editor of the newspaper over in, oh, well, the publisher of the newspaper over in Henry County, the Henry mm-hmm. County Local.
Mm-hmm.
And wherever we've gone, Fredericksburg, she was the co-chairman of Keep Fredericksburg Beautiful. And when it came to move, she didn't want to move from Lexington. She didn't want to move from Arlington, Virginia. She didn't want to move from all of these different places, but never a word of complaint. She just started packing the boxes and unpacking the boxes, packing and unpacking. And I've got to say that she contributed to this wonderful life that I have lived. She contributed, and without her, it would have been not good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
303.